Okay, welcome. My name's Divine. This is episode 179 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In this podcast, I'll be reviewing some more cardiac pathologies. I've reviewed some of this already, but I want to review some of these pathologies using our clinical vignettes, and I also want to highlight some other high-yield important things pertaining to these materials on exams. So let's get right to it. So what if you get a question about a patient, and this patient has had fevers for the last 2 weeks, and then they tell you that you auscultated a new murmur on exam? What's your diagnosis? Well, I would hope you're thinking about endocarditis, right? So endocarditis classically presents with the dyad of fever and the new murmur. And on MBME exams, you want to be able to differentiate between acute endocarditis and subacute endocarditis, okay? Acute endocarditis and subacute endocarditis. Acute endocarditis is almost always caused by Staph aureus for purposes of the USMLE exams, right? It's the kind of endocarditis that develops over days, right, and tends to have a more severe presentation. And then subacute endocarditis tends to be caused by the strep viridans, and it typically develops over like weeks, stuff like that. And the thing is, the MBME, they may ask you about like the greatest risk factor that a person has for having endocarditis. You want to think about IV drug use. IV drug use predisposes people to endocarditis, right? Having like a congenital heart defect predisposes one to endocarditis. Having like bacteria in your blood also predisposes one to endocarditis. Or having like a cardiac valve that's like damaged or not working properly also predisposes one to endocarditis. And the thing is, you want to keep in mind that viridan strep tends to affect valves that have been damaged, right? Or valves that are not normal, versus Staph aureus that can actually affect the... Staph aureus can obviously affect valves that are not normal, but it can also affect valves that are previously normal, right? Valves that have no issues whatsoever. And remember, with regards to endocarditis, right, like your first step in management is always to obtain a blood culture, right? So you obtain blood cultures, right? And typically you also perform some kind of echocardiography to look for vegetations on the heart. And one thing I'll go ahead and say is that most cases of endocarditis tend to involve the left side of the heart, and they are almost always accompanied by damage to the mitral valve. And most times these the valvular lesions that come up end up causing a regurgitation. Now, the thing with endocarditis is, why is endocarditis bad? I mean, obviously it causes infection, right? Endocarditis can cause a chronic disease. So you may get an MBME question about a person that has like endocarditis, and then they have like high ferritin, low TIBC. They may have either a normocytic or a microcytic anemia, right? That will be an anemia of chronic disease in the setting of chronic endocarditis. Other things that can happen with endocarditis is that these vegetations, right, some of them are very friable, right, so they're very fragile. So the thing is, in some cases, these vegetations can actually break off and embolize to different parts of the body, right? So if, for example, a person has like a left heart, if a person has a left heart valve endocarditis, that left heart valve, the vegetations can break off and go to the brain and cause a lot of trouble for the patient, right? Can break off, cause a lot of trouble for the patient, go to the brain, cause like an infarction. Or as those vegetations break off, one thing that can actually happen is they break off, right, with bacteria and go to wall. They go to like blood vessels in the brain, and then they cause an infection and they weaken the walls of those blood vessels. And when they weaken the walls of those blood vessels, one thing that can happen is you can actually develop like an aneurysm of those blood vessels. That is what is known as a mycotic aneurysm. Okay, that's what's known as a mycotic aneurysm. And then if you have like right-sided endocarditis, right, so endocarditis of a valve on the right side of the heart, that can certainly cause problems like in the lungs, right? So that can cause like a pulmonary embolus, right? Or it can cause like a pulmonary abscess, okay? So those are all high yield things to keep at the back of your mind for purposes of the USMLE exams. Now, like I said, right, again, you typically want to do some kind of blood culture to diagnose endocarditis, right? And we know that, yes, infection is the most common for the most part, is the most common cause of endocarditis. But the thing is, there are also other causes of endocarditis that are not infectious, right? So these things tend to be called as sterile endocarditis, okay? They tend to be called sterile endocarditis. And sterile endocarditis, one big thing you want to keep in mind with it is it can be caused by things like lupus, right? So like lupus, there's this thing called like Lippmann-Sachs endocarditis that can happen in people with lupus. I remember there's a classic mnemonic for this, right? That SLE can cause LSC, right? And then there is something else known as Marantic endocarditis. That's another kind of sterile endocarditis. Some people call it like the non-bacterial thrombotic endocarditis. They call it a thrombotic endocarditis because for whatever reason, these are Marantic cases of endocarditis. They love to spread, okay? Like they are very friable, and these things tend to cause a lot of embolica phenomena. Now, the thing is, if a person has endocarditis, right, they typically get IV antibiotics for many weeks. So you may say, Divine, why do they get IV antibiotics for many weeks? Well, the thing is, they get these IV antibiotics for many weeks because, again, remember, endocarditis, right, typically affects cardiac valves. And the thing is, unfortunately, cardiac valves don't have much in the way of decent blood supply, right? Like cardiac valves, for the most part, it's almost like dealing with, it's not entirely like cartilage, but it's almost like it's almost like cartilage in terms of blood supply. So they tend to not have great blood supply, right? So because they don't have great blood supply, the antibiotics have a lot of trouble getting to the site of endocarditis. That's why these people typically end up needing prolonged antibiotic therapy. So I will say for the most part, those are kind of like the big things to know about endocarditis. I mean, obviously, if a person has endocarditis and you give antibiotics, it's not helping, and you need to do a valve replacement, then you need to do that valve replacement, I guess. And the thing is, I guess some key things you want to keep at the back of your mind with valve replacements, right, is that if you're replacing a person's valve, you can do one of two things, right? You can do one of two things. You can either give them like a bioprosthetic valve, okay? Usually that's done, that's gotten from pigs, right? Or you can do a mechanical valve, right? So like a mechanical valve. There are some key differences that your friends at the MBM expect you to know with these valves, right? So let's talk about the porcine valves first. The thing is, the porcine valves, right? The good thing about these ones is that you don't need anticoagulation while you're on that valve, okay? Only problem with those valves is that they tend to not last for long periods of time, right? So after about 10 years, these valves are not effective anymore, right? Because the thing that happens is that, you know, they undergo wear and tear, and then your body begins to deposit calcium within these valves. So over time, people that have like these bioprosthetic valves, they end up developing like stenosis of whatever valve that was replaced. Contrast this with a mechanical valve. A mechanical valve, the big thing with this one is it lasts longer, right? It's like very structurally sound. But the problem is you do need to be on anticoagulation for a prolonged period of time. The reason behind this is that if you think about it, right, a mechanical valve is essentially like a non-biologic surface. So because it's a non-biologic surface, right, it's very prone to thrombosis, right? So these people typically are on MBMEs, they are on warfarin. I will encourage you to not pick any other anticoagulant for a person that has a mechanical valve other than warfarin, right? And then these valves, right, because again, they are non-biologic, they are very prone to also having like bugs grow on them, right? So endocarditis is a very common complication of mechanical valve or prosthesis, right? And the thing is, you want to be able to divvy it up by the 60-day timeline, right? If a person has endocarditis of a mechanical valve, right, and it's like less than 60 days after they got the valve replaced, then you want to think about things like a staph epidermidis. But if it's more than 60 days, so like late prosthetic valve endocarditis, you want to think more along the lines of a staph aureus. Again, these are all important things to know. And then remember that a person that has these mechanical valves, they can also give you a question about a person, you know, they got like a mechanical valve replacement like 3 months ago, and then they tell you that this person's, has been having shortness of breath, and then they show you labs, and you notice that the person's hemoglobin is very low, right? and the person has a normocytic anemia, so the MCV is between 80 to 100, and then you notice that the person has like an elevated LDH, a decreased haptoglobin, and then they tell you that on a blood smear you see schistocytes, you definitely want to think about hemolysis that's occurring with that valve, right? Hemolysis that's occurring with the valve. The thing is, valves, these are prosthetic valves, although the newer ones, you know, are a lot better, but back in the day, some of these mechanical valves, they tended to be like, you know, pretty prone to hemolysis, right? So they can give you like a hemolytic anemia style picture. So the person will have like elevated LDH, decreased haptoglobin, right? They'll have like an indirect hyperbilirubinemia. You'll find schistocytes on a blood smear. Okay, so those are all big things you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams. Now, one unusual thing that people don't typically know, and is maybe not in too many resources, is one high yield thing I actually want you to keep in mind is this thing known as a Heide syndrome. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, but I'll spell it right. It's H-E-Y-D-E, Heide syndrome. It's a classic MBME presentation where they'll give you a question about a person that has aortic stenosis, right? And then they'll tell you that this person has been having like hemocore positive stools. Whenever you see the mixture of a GI bleed and the aortic stenosis, think about Heide syndrome. Think about Heide syndrome. The pathophysiology is not super well understood, but if you read the literature, some things you'll see is that people say that, oh, by having this aortic stenosis, these people are cleaving von Willebrand factor multimers. So because von Willebrand factor is taken out of the picture, you're not able to do primary hemostasis. And if you're not able to do primary hemostasis, then that can cause bleeding, right? So people think it's like a bleeding diathesis that arises in the setting of aortic stenosis from cleaving von Willebrand factor multimers. Okay, that's again something very high yield that for whatever reason tends to show up on exams. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient, and this patient recently delivered a child, and then they tell you that this patient for the last 1 week she has been having severe shortness of breath, and then they tell you that she has like GVD, and they tell you that, oh, when you auscultate her lungs, you hear crackles, bilateral crackles at the basis of both lungs, then what are you thinking about? Well, I would really hope you're thinking about some kind of peripartum cardiomyopathy. All right, remember, if a person has cardiomyopathy in the peripartum period, it's almost always a dilated cardiomyopathy on MBME exams. And remember, the word cardiomyopathy, right, literally, notice, cardiomyopathy, right, it's a problem with cardiac myocytes, right? So, and remember, I mean, I've kind of mentioned this in the other podcast, but again, there were some key things I wanted to touch on here. But there are many things that can cause a cardiomyopathy, right? So there's like the dilated cardiomyopathy, there's the restrictive cardiomyopathy, there's the hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, right? And the thing is, when a person has a dilated cardiomyopathy, you want to know some key causes, right? So you want to remember that you can have dilated cardiomyopathy in the peripartum period, right? It can be in a woman that's just about to deliver a child or recently just delivered a child. That's usually a dilated cardiomyopathy. If you also see a person with myocarditis, right, from like Coxsackie A, Coxsackie B virus, typically it tends to be Coxsackie B on MBME exams. After myocarditis, that can cause a dilated cardiomyopathy. And please remember that myocarditis can also be caused by drugs, right? It can be caused by drugs like a doxorubicin, donorubicin, anthracyclines. It can be caused by trastuzumab, right? Remember, that's that HER2 inhibitor that's used to treat breast cancer that is HER2 positive, like ERBB2, and then also clozapine, the antipsychotic, the atypical antipsychotic that can cause agranulocytosis but also decreases the risk of suicide, is also associated with the development of myocarditis. And again, myocarditis can be followed up by dilated cardiomyopathy. And then if a person is a chronic alcohol user, right, that can also cause a dilated cardiomyopathy. That's the thing that is known as a wet beriberi, right? And the thing is, if a person also has a myocardial infarction, right, if a person has an MI, and then they tell you that they develop a cardiomyopathy afterwards, also think about dilated cardiomyopathy. Many people tend to call it ischemic cardiomyopathy. It's a classic thing that happens after people have like large MIs, especially people that have like infarcts of the left anterior descending artery, right? And then the thing is, the MBME, right, they may give you a question about a patient, you know, they'll tell you that this patient has like skin hyperpigmentation, has like new onset diabetes, and then they'll tell you that the person has been having like heart failure style symptoms, so like GVD, crackles in the lungs. And then they tell you that, oh, that when they get imaging of the chest, they see like bilateral dilation of the ventricles. And then they may ask you which of the following will be the most likely finding on a pathological analysis of like a biopsy sample from the person's heart, right? You would want to look for the answer choice that involves some kind of Prussian blue staining, right? Remember, this person likely has a hereditary hemochromatosis, right? So whenever you see a person, especially like an old person that, you know, they've not had diabetes all their lives, and then like somehow in their 50s they suddenly develop diabetes and they have like skin hyperpigmentation, you want to think about hereditary hemochromatosis, right? Remember, hemochromatosis, it arises from a HFE gene mutation, right? And these people tend to have increased iron reabsorption, right? And it has a lot of high yield associations for the purposes of the USMLEs, right? So, you make the diagnosis, you screen for these people first by, you know, checking their ferritin levels or their transferrin saturation levels, they'll be elevated. And then you also want to look for other associations, right? So these people tend to have diabetes because they can deposit iron and cause like free radical damage with accompanying fibrosis of the pancreas, right? These people can also have a dilated cardiomyopathy, right? They can also have a restrictive cardiomyopathy. They can have erectile dysfunction because they can deposit iron and kind of like damage some part of their reproductive tract, I think like the vas deferens, if I'm not mistaken. And then remember that hemochromatosis can also cause CPPD, right? So like pseudo gout, right? So they describe a person that has like chondrocalcinosis on imaging and they have like a chronic arthritis, think about CPPD. Pseudo gout, remember, that's the thing that's associated with rhomboid shaped positively birefringent crystals on the polarized light, right? So again, these are all important things to keep in mind for exams. And then remember that it's not just hemochromatosis, right, that can also cause the similar presentation, right? If a person has like, you know, like beta thal major and they get transfusions all the time and they have iron overload, that could also ultimately lead to some kind of a dilated cardiomyopathy. And then what if you get a question about like a three-year-old child? They tell you that this three-year-old child dies suddenly from like a very nasty arrhythmia. And then they tell you that this child, on biopsy of the heart, they notice that most of the cardiac muscle has, like, that they barely find any cardiac muscle, and they notice a lot of like adipocytes within the parenchyma of the heart. What are you thinking about on your exam? Well, I would hope you're thinking about something known as ARVD. Okay, ARVD. ARVD is known as arrhythmogenic right ventricular dysplasia, right? Although some people also call it ARVC, arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy. Okay, it's a kind of cardiomyopathy. The key things, there's not much you need to know about this for purposes of exams, but some key things you need to remember is that it's inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion. Okay, that's one. Second thing you want to remember is that it's associated with mutations in desmosome proteins. Okay, it's associated with mutations in desmosome proteins, so things like plicoglobin, for example, right? So these people tend to have a lot of issues with like gap junctions. Remember, in the hearts, the gap junctions are your intercalated discs, right? And they sort of help with like electrical connectivity between our two cardiac myocytes. And for the most part, these people tend to get like right heart failure, okay? They tend to get right heart failure. But the thing is, because you're essentially replacing cardiac myocytes with like fibrotic tissue and with adipocytes, these people are very prone to developing arrhythmias, right? And they can have a sudden cardiac death. That's actually something, again, very, very important to keep in mind for exams. And then the next thing I'll talk about, right, what if you get a question about like an athlete collapses on the field and dies, right? Hopefully you're thinking about hypertrophic cardiomyopathy under those circumstances. I remember, right, that these people, key things you want to remember is they tend, I almost think of like ARVC as the close cousin of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, because people that have hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, they tend to, like, say that ARVC tends to involve the right ventricle. People that have HCM, it tends to involve more of the the left ventricle, right, and the interventricular septum, right? So you have like marked dilation of the like marked hypertrophy of the left ventricle, but in addition to that, they will also have asymmetric interventricular septal hypertrophy, and the interventricular septum, it kind of bulges into the left ventricle, and then they can have like a dynamic left ventricular outflow tract obstruction, because whenever the ventricle is contracting, that brings that asymmetrically hypertrophied interventricular septum close to the anterior leaflet of the mitral valve, and that can cause a dynamic LVOT. Remember that in general, so LVOT means left ventricular outflow tract obstruction, right? And the thing is, remember that the murmur of HCM actually tends to be heard in the left lower sternal border, but it sounds an awful lot like aortic stenosis. Remember, I think in cardio podcast, I think maybe 6 or 5, I talked about some key differences between HCM and aortic stenosis. And again, you may say, Divine, this podcast almost seems like a repeat of a prior podcast you've done. And yes, that is true to an extent, but I'm also introducing quite a bit of new information here. And I'm just trying to kind of talk about things from a slightly different perspective from what I used. Because the thing is, unlike step 2 CK and step 3, step 1 tends to be a more detail-oriented exam, right? So there are just some key unusual details that may crop up with these disorders that I want to make sure that I highlight and make obvious, even if I've mentioned them before, so that people are prepared for the exams. And that's why I will try to keep this podcast really short, because it's almost like an add-on podcast to something that I have made already. Now, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, some key things you want to keep in mind is, you know, you tend to treat these people with beta blockers, right? You tend to place ICDs, right? So that, because these people tend to get like nasty arrhythmias from the these problems they have with like the left ventricular wall and the interventricular septum. And you want to remember that hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion, right? And some key things you want to recognize, at least some key proteins you want to remember. Sometimes the NBME may be generous and they may say, oh, it's the right answer will be like mutations in sarcomere proteins, but there are some other protein mutations that can cause a HCM, right? So things like mutations in like beta myosin heavy chain, or like myosin binding protein C, or even like mutations in like troponin and tropomyosin, those can all give rise to HCM, right? And again, these people, they are supposed to avoid strenuous exercises. You need to put them on beta blockers, because if you put them on beta blockers, that will slow down the heart. The heart will spend more time in diastole, so they will have better ventricular filling, right? Because these people tend to have diastolic dysfunction from the HCM. Now, one thing that the NBME also kind of expects you to know is that when a person has a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, on histology, you'll see myocardial disarray. That is the classic finding on histology in a person that has hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And then, remember, if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, has a history of like, you know, they tell you that this person has a like a history like renal, like new onset renal failure, right? And then they give you labs and you notice that the calcium is like 12. And then the person always complains of like low back pain, right? And then the person also has like a normocytic anemia, right? I would hope under those circumstances, you're thinking about multiple myeloma. Well, people that have multiple myeloma, right, they tend to, they can also develop like a restrictive cardiomyopathy, where the AL amyloid, right, can deposit in the heart, and then they can get like amyloidosis in the heart, which can cause again a restrictive cardiomyopathy style picture, right? So obviously these people have a lot of diastolic dysfunction, but remember though that multiple myeloma is not the only thing that can cause a cardiac amyloidosis, right? Like if a person has any kind of like, again, chronic inflammatory state, like endocarditis, right? Or a person has some of these like autoimmune diseases where like their body is in like always on inflammation, that can also cause cardiac amyloidosis, right? And then also remember that if a person has you know, like an old person, like very old people can also have like cardiac amyloid from like a protein known as a transthyretin. That is something very high yield to recognize for exams, right? These things can all cause cardiac amyloidosis. And again, remember the classic finding of apocrine birefringence on Congo red stain. And again, this is associated with diastolic dysfunction. Okay, it's associated with diastolic dysfunction. if you see like a restrictive cardiomyopathy in very young kids, especially like kids that are like a year old, 2 years old, there are two things I want you to keep at the back of your mind on exams. One you should keep in mind is Pompe's disease. Remember, Pompe's disease is glycogen storage disease type 2. Yes, it's called the glycogen storage disease, but it's actually more of like a lysosomal storage disease in disguise, right? Remember, the enzyme that's deficient in Pompe's disease is alpha-1,4-glucosidase. Sometimes that's what's known as acid maltase. Okay, that's the thing that's deficient in GSD type 2, right? So because those people lack acid maltase, they're unable to break down glycogen in the lysosome, right? Remember, the enzyme is called acid maltase because the lysosome is an acidic environment, and maltase tells you that, ace, right? Whenever you say the word ace, it means it breaks down something, right? So acid maltase, also again called alpha-1,4-glucosidase or glucosidase, whichever way you pronounce it, helps with breaking down glycogen in the lysosome. And if you can break down that glycogen, it'll build up in the lysosomes of the cardiac myocytes, and then those people will get into trouble. I mean, that's something known as a Pompe glycogenosis, okay? It's a cause of restrictive cardiomyopathy in young kids. And let me just take a quick sidebar here, right? So the thing is, many times people confuse this because there is one glycogen storage disease that's associated with a mutation in alpha-1,4-glucosidase. And then there is another glycogen storage disease that is associated with a mutation in alpha-1,6-glucosidase, right? So people tell me, like, Divine, how is it possible to remember this? Well, let me give you a trick. The thing is, in Pompe's disease, which is GSD type 2, it's a mutation in alpha-1,4-glucosidase. In Corey's disease, which is GSD type 3, it's a mutation in alpha-1,6-glucosidase. The trick to use is, if you remember, Pompe's disease is GSD type 2. If you take 2 times 2, 2 times 2 is 4, alpha-1,4-glucosidase. If you take Corey's disease, GSD type 3, if you take 3 times 2, that's 6, that's alpha-1,6-glucosidase. So take the number of the glycogen storage disease and multiply by 2, and you'll know the glucosidase number for the enzyme that's deficient. So I hope you find that helpful on exams. So I said, if you see restrictive cardiomyopathy in a kid, like a 1 or 2 year old kid, one thing you should think about is Pompe's disease, right? Remember, heart failure is probably the most common cause of death in kids with Pompe's disease. But another thing you want to keep at the back of your mind is something called endocardial fibroelastosis, okay? Endocardial fibroelastosis. The thing that just happens is that it just happens in kids, and again, classically happens in little kids on MBM exams, and they deposit all this like fibroelastic tissue in the heart, and that ultimately causes diastolic dysfunction. So those people tend to have like a restrictive cardiomyopathy picture. And then, like I already said earlier, right, again, dilated cardiomyopathy, it can arise after myocarditis, right? And again, remember, myocarditis, again, like viruses, Coxsackie A, Coxsackie B, although classically it's Coxsackie B on MBM exams. And then I already talked about some drugs that can cause myocarditis, right? And remember that this bug, especially if they give you like a question about like a patient that has like AIDS, right, and they have a CD4 count less than 100, and then they tell you that they have like a dilated cardiomyopathy, one thing you certainly want to think about is Toxoplasma gondii, okay, T. gondii. Remember, you prophylax against that when a person's CD4 count drops below 100 with the administration of a TMP-SMX. Although remember, if a person has T. gondii, the way you actually treat it is with pyrimethamine and sulfadiazine, which is different from trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, right? So T. gondii can actually cause a myocarditis, right? And the thing is, whenever you have these bug causes of myocarditis, classically on, they'll tell you that, that when you look at the person's, when you perform like, you know, like a biopsy or something, and you look at the person's myocardium on imaging, I mean, on like on histology, you'll see like a lot of like chronic inflammatory cells, right? So you see like lymphocytes, you see macrophages, right? You'll see like cells that essentially belong to your mononuclear system on biopsy. Okay, and remember that T. gondii, right, it's also not just only common in people with HIV, right, but people that are exposed to cat litter, right, especially like pregnant women, that predisposes them to getting a toxoplasmosis. Okay, so those are again all high yield things to keep in mind. Remember, some other things that can also cause myocarditis that can again eventually lead to dilated cardiomyopathy are things like Lyme disease. Okay, Lyme disease actually has a very strong association with the development of myocarditis. I mean, like 1 in 20 patients that have Lyme disease can actually ultimately go on to develop a
ultimately go on to develop myocarditis. And then remember, if they describe a person from South America that has myocarditis, right, think about Trypanosoma cruzii. Okay, remember, Trypanosoma cruzii causes big problems, right? It can cause dilated cardiomyopathy, so big heart from myocarditis. It can cause a big esophagus. It can cause achalasia, right? And it can also cause Hirschsprung disease. Okay, it can also cause Hirschsprung disease, right? So if they describe a person, you know, is from South America, maybe dies from like a bad arrhythmia, and then they tell you that, oh, that they obtain the biopsy at autopsy, and they notice that, oh, you see like pseudocysts interspersed with the person's myocardium that contains a lot of amastigotes, then you want to think about a Chagas disease, okay, from a Trypanosoma cruzii, okay, that can ultimately lead again to a dilated cardiomyopathy. And then remember that there are certain people that can have like almost like a sterile kind of myocarditis. One thing that can cause a sterile myocarditis are drugs, right? Like those drugs I mentioned, like your anthracyclines, your clozapin, your trastuzumab. Those can all cause a sterile myocarditis. But another thing that can also cause a sterile myocarditis is this idiopathic condition known as a giant cell myocarditis. The prognosis is terrible. I mean, I think I may have seen clinically worked with a patient that has had this before. It has a terrible prognosis. And the classic presentation on MBME exams, you'll be in a young person, right? Like a very young person. And then the person will just have like this rapidly progressive, like a heart failure, pretty much, right? That arises from myocarditis. And typically, the thing that will happen is, when you get like an endomyocardial biopsy of these people, also they will classically tell you this on exams. They'll tell you that on biopsy, you see a lot of like giant cells and granulomas within the interspersed with the person's myocardium. If you see that, you really want to think about a giant cell myocarditis under those circumstances. And then, I think I may have talked about this in one of my earlier podcasts, right? But remember, anything that comes between the epicardium and the pericardium, right, that can begin to compress on the heart and cause troubles with the heart feeling, right? The person will have like a diastolic dysfunction kind of picture, right? So if a person has like a pericardial effusion, right, that can ultimately progress, especially if the fluid builds up fast and builds up big, right, like a big effusion. Those things can all lead to like cardiac tamponade. Remember, in cardiac tamponade, there's the classic Beck's triad of like hypotension, jugular venous distension, and muffled heart sounds, right? And then the person will be like, you know, profoundly hypotensive, hemodynamically unstable. And under those circumstances, right, you want to do something called a pericardial, not paracentesis. Paracentesis is for ascites, right? This is pericardiocentesis, okay? So don't make that mistake on exams. Other things that can also happen, right, like if a person has like cancer and the cancer like metastasizes to the person's pericardium, right, again, that can cause like a pericardial effusion, and that can again ultimately lead to tamponade. If a person has chronic kidney disease and they have uremia, that can again, uremia can cause a pericarditis, and if the pericarditis goes on for long enough, that can also cause a pericardial effusion. So again, these are all things to keep at the back of your mind on exams. Or if a person even has aortic dissection, if a person has like a proximal aortic, like if the aorta is dissecting proximally back towards the heart, you can put a ton of blood in the person's pericardial space, right? So they can have like a hemopericardium. And again, that can lead to like acute diastolic dysfunction of the heart. And it can actually cause a very rapid death, right? These people need cardiac surgery like yesterday. And remember that if they want to show you, like, if they want to give you a question about a person having, like, cardiac tamponade or a pericardial effusion, they can actually show you, like, a CT scan of the chest, right? And you'll notice a lot of, like, fluid that's, like, hypodense surrounding the heart, right? If you see that, you really want to think about, like a pericardial effusion. Or sometimes they may show you a chest x-ray and they may show you the heart having almost like a globular configuration. You really want to again think about like a pericardial effusion under those circumstances. And then again, if they show you like an image of the heart and you see like calcification surrounding the heart, you want to think about constrictive pericarditis. Remember, constrictive pericarditis tends to have an association with something called a pulsus paradoxus, right? So where the systolic blood pressure decreases by more than 10 millimeters of mercury with inspiration, right? And remember, the mechanism behind that is that when a person has constrictive pericarditis, like really the side of the heart it tends to affect the most is the right ventricle, right? So if, you know, you inspire, venous return would increase, Well, because the heart has diastolic dysfunction from the calcification that's encasing the heart, the interventricular septum then has to deal with that increased like workload, it has to bulge like more than normal into the person's left ventricle. And if that happens, the left ventricle will not feel as well. And if it doesn't feel well, right, so if you don't have enough diastolic filling of the left ventricle, then obviously your stroke volume is going to go down, right? So that will decrease your systolic blood pressure by a decent amount, right? That's what's known as Bolso's paradoxus. Another thing you can also see with constrictive pericarditis on MBME exams is something known as Kussmaul sign, right? So what is Kussmaul sign? Kussmaul sign is what's known as like an increase in jugular venous pulsation with inspiration. That is not supposed to happen. The thing is, when you inspire, again, you're almost creating like a vacuum effect in the right side of the heart. So that draws fluid, draws blood from the jugular venous system to the heart. So your jugular veins should collapse on inspiration, right? But if they expand on inspiration, that's what's known as Kussmaul sign. And again, it classically arises on MBME exams in a person that has constrictive pericarditis. Because when they have that constrictive pericarditis, their heart cannot fill. So it can, when those people inspire, right, that increased venous return, the heart cannot handle it, right? So it's almost like you have a blowback of blood into the jugular venous system. So those people have like distension of the jugular veins. So again, these are all high yield things to keep in mind for exams. And then remember, like your classic fibrinous pericarditis, right? It can arise in many settings, but classically on MBME exams, they tend to put this in the context of a person that recently had an MI, right? Like, oh, like 3 to 5 days after an MI, where they have like fibrinous pericarditis, or they tell you like, you know, a couple of weeks after they had the MI. That's what's known as a Dressler syndrome. Remember, that's an autoimmune pericarditis. And remember that for pericarditis in general, your first line treatment is an NSAID, okay? NSAIDs tend to help very well with the treatment of pericarditis. If that's not cutting it, you can give like steroids. If that's not cutting, you can give like colchicine. I remember that pericarditis classically presents with a person that has chest pain that is worse when they lie back and is better when they lean forward. And on an EKG, don't forget that pericarditis tends to be associated with like a diffuse ST segment elevation and a diffuse PR segment depression. Okay, those are all classic findings on EKG in a person that has pericarditis. And then if a person has like a large pericardial effusion, if a person has cardiac tamponade, on EKG, right, you should expect a low voltage EKG. That is actually one of the most common causes of a low voltage EKG on MBME exams. Although remember that restrictive cardiomyopathy, or whenever you have any kind of infiltrative disease of the heart, can also be associated with a low voltage EKG. And then another thing you may see in cardiac tamponade on MBME exams on EKG is electrical alternance, right, where you have like varying amplitudes of the QRS complex. That happens because, again, the heart is essentially like dancing in fluid, right? So as the heart comes closer to the EKG lead, you get a bigger signal from the left ventricle. As the heart departs from the EKG lead, you get a smaller signal from the left ventricle, right? So that's the thing that ultimately causes that's the thing that ultimately causes that electrical alternance. Now, what if they give you a question about a person, you know, from a developing country, and this person, you know, like over the last 1 year, they've been having like shortness of breath, right? And they've been having like jugular venous distension. And then they tell you that, oh, on physical exam, you also see like this again, distension of the jugular veins with inspiration, right? Telling you that, oh, this person has got constrictive pericarditis. And then they ask, what's the most likely etiology of this person's disorder? I really hope you're thinking about TB, okay? TB is one of the most common causes of pericarditis in the developing world. Okay, and again, remember, constrictive pericarditis, classic finding on imaging is calcifications around the heart. Okay, calcifications around the heart. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient? They tell you that for the last 6 months, this patient has lost 20 pounds, has fevers all the time, right? And this person has had like two episodes where they temporarily lost vision in one eye. What are you thinking? And they tell you that, oh, on auscultation of the chest, you hear something called like a diastolic plop sound. If you see that, I really hope you're thinking about a cardiac myxoma. Okay, a cardiac myxoma. Remember, the big high points with cardiac myxomas, they tend to be found in the left atrium, right? That's one. And the thing is, these myxomas, right, they can produce like these ball valve effects. They can essentially replicate mitral stenosis, right? So they can begin to cause problems with like left ventricular filling. So these patients that have myxomas, they can have syncopal episodes, right? That's one. And again, classically, they'll tell you that you hear like a diastolic murmur on auscultation of the chest. And these things also tend to be pedunculated, right? That's why they can exert this ball valve effect. And the thing is, these tumors, they can actually do some pretty weird things, right? So one thing that can happen is that certain like some little parts of the tumor can break off and then embolize to the brain and cause a stroke or a TIA, right? That those are transient loss of vision episodes I described in the vignette. But another thing that can also happen is that these tumors can produce interleukin 6, right? Remember, interleukin 6 is a pyrogen, so it can cause fever. Okay, it can cause fever. And really, the way you make the diagnosis of these myxomas, you can diagnose them on imaging pretty well. Usually you can do like some kind of echocardiography, and you'll see that pretty well. And usually surgical treatment, you do surgery, and these people get markedly better. And then some weird things, again, this is probably not step 2 CK material, but more step 1 material. If they give you a question about a patient that has like multiple cardiac myxomas, or they even have myxomas not just in the heart but in other parts of the body, you want to think about two diseases, okay? You want to think about McCune-Albright syndrome. Remember, McCune-Albright syndrome tends to be associated with like an activating mutation in a gene known as a GNAS1, so like GNAS1, okay? So McCune-Albright syndrome can be associated with like multiple the presence or development of multiple cardiac and extra cardiac myxomas. But also there's this disease known as the Carney complex. Okay, some people call it like Carney syndrome. So C-A-R-N-E-Y. It also tends to be associated with the development of multiple cardiac myxomas, right? And then what if they give you a question about a child that dies from like a really bad sudden arrhythmia, and they tell you that this child has like hypopigmented macules on the skin, blah, 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 blah. I hope that you're thinking about like tuberous sclerosis, right? Remember, tuberous sclerosis can be associated with like cardiac rhabdomyomas. So that's like the cardiac tumor they tend to develop. So it can be associated with, again, cardiac rhabdomyomas. And remember, the hypopigmented macules I'm referring to on the skin are your classically described ash leaf spots, okay? And again, these people can have these cardiac rhabdomyomas, and that can predispose them to having like arrhythmias and having like diastolic dysfunction occasionally. And the thing is, these things, for the most part, they tend to be hematomas, right? So in some cases, believe it or not, they actually just regress spontaneously, right? But again, if you see a kid with tuberous sclerosis and they have a cardiac mass, think about the hematoma that is known as a cardiac rhabdomyoma. Okay, again, these are all high yield things to know. For the most part, they tend to arise like in the left ventricle, or they kind of arise along the interventricular septum. And then remember that rhabdomyomas, right? Like if you look at the name, rhabdomyoma, right? I don't see rhabdomyosarcoma. Rhabdomyosarcoma is obviously worse than having a rhabdomyoma. It's like malignant. It arises from like malignant degeneration of a rhabdomyoma. And then one thing I think I want to mention that you want to remember is the most common kind of cardiac tumor is actually metastasis, right? Primary cardiac tumors are extremely rare. Okay, they're extremely rare. They're extremely rare. Okay, so again, these are all things to keep in mind for exams. And then if the one other, I guess, primary cardiac tumor you want to keep in mind. So we've talked about like the myxomas, we've talked about the rhabdomyomas. You also want to not forget the angiosarcomas. Okay, remember, angiosarcomas can arise in the liver from a person that has a polyvinyl chloride exposure, but angiosarcomas can also arise in the heart. Okay, they can also arise in the heart. And again, they have like a terrible prognosis, terrible, terrible, terrible prognosis. And the thing is, your friends at the NBME, they want you to remember that because these are like muscle-based tumors, they tend to be positive for vimentin, okay? They tend to be positive for vimentin. Vimentin is a very high-yield like cardiac muscle marker you want to recognize on exams. And these things also tend to be like CD34. CD34 positive. The reason that I'm saying that you should recognize this CD34 positivity is that mesotheliomas, because again, many people on MBMEs are like, oh, mesotheliomas are always just in the lungs. No, mesotheliomas can also arise in the heart. Okay, mesotheliomas can also arise in the heart. They can also arise in the peritoneal cavity, believe it or not, right? So the thing is, when a person has a cardiac mesothelioma, that tends to be CD34 negative. So that's the way you can differentiate a cardiac angiosarcoma from a cardiac mesothelioma, okay? Cardiac angiosarcomas tend to be CD34 and vimentin positive. Cardiac mesotheliomas tend to be CD34 negative, okay? Again, these are, again, you may say, oh, Divine, this is low. I promise you it's not low yield to many of these things. Step one is, unfortunately, a very detailed exam, right? So it's just something that you definitely want to make sure you keep in mind and know for tests. And then the last thing I'll just talk about is, you know, if a person has you know, like a heart transplant. Remember, obviously, right, all heart transplants will fail at some point. The big thing you want to remember is that the mechanism behind ultimate like failure of a heart transplant is that, again, all the chronic inflammation that happens because it's like a foreign thing you're putting in the person's body happens because you ultimately causes like an arteriopathy, right? So you begin to have problems with the arteries. You have all this inflammation of the arteries, you narrow the lumina, and then ultimately the cardiac transplant fails. And for the most part, it tends to be mediated by T cells, okay? So that's a big thing you want to keep at the back of your mind. Like chronic transplant rejection, especially with the heart, tends to be associated with T cells, okay? So I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. Again, I like the other almost like direction. So it's one of those things where you have to listen to both podcasts to like kind of like get like a complete picture. Occasionally, I just have these topics where I'm like, okay, I want to talk about it from one perspective and then talk about it from a different perspective. Just again, as a means of preparing you nicely for these exams. And cardiology, again, is very high yield for just for every USMLE exam, including step one. So I'm really taking my sweet time to make sure that I cover all my bases so that if you listen to these cardiology podcasts, you have like a complete thorough review of cardiology for the USMLE exams. So as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams, step one, step two CK, step two CS, step three. I also do this thing called longitudinal tutoring, where I tutor you for like your class exams, your block exams, and also for your like upcoming USMLE exams, right? So if you're a first year, second or third year medical student, I can tutor you for like your block exams, your shelf exams, but at the same time, I'm also longitudinally tutoring you for your USMLE exams. Many people tend to find this helpful. And then I also do this USMLE booster course. It's like 10 hours for step two CK and step three, and 20 hours for step one, where if you're at the end of your dedicated period, or you feel like your knowledge base is pretty good, or you're looking for just that quick boost in your score, this course may be something that you may find to be helpful. Basically, in a very short time period, I review like a lot of the high yields, like a lot of the must knows for the USMLE exams in a Q&A format, rapid fire format. I mean, obviously, if you want a longer review, I can obviously offer that. It will just be more hours. And then if you're a college student that's applying to med school, so like an AMCAS app, or a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS app, I do offer like advising and coaching for this stuff, right? So like mock interviews, rec letters, personal statements, editing applications. Again, I have like top two med school admissions committee experience. So I've read thousands of high quality applications. And again, I've also worked with tons of people like trying to match into residency. And again, a very nice majority of them have matched at programs of their choice. And then if you're a medicine resident, I need tutoring for the internal medicine entering exam or the ABIM board exam. I also offer tutoring for that. And then if you're a college student needing tutoring for like the MCAT or for subjects like general chemistry, OCHEM, physics, biochem, histology, physiology, I'll also offer tutoring for all those things. So have a wonderful rest of your day. I will see you in the next podcast. God bless you. Thank you and happy new month.